most of what we're thinking and doing most of the time is automatic or semi-automatic processes. Some would argue that we're never conscious, because by the time you think you've got a conscious thought, it's so polluted with biases and belief systems, it's not actually conscious. It's not a fresh idea that's just come into your head. It's contaminated, for better or for worse, with all of the experiences that you've had in your life, right? And this is why AI is going to be so disruptive to the world of work, because it can do automatic, semi-automatic thinking processes like we've never seen before.
Hello. Today, I'm talking and learning from Dr. John Finn. He is the founder of a consultancy called Tougher Minds. And we dig into his work in business and his work in performance sport and his work in education. He's been doing this for 20 years. And his first book was Habit Mechanic, which is a 9-point model. And we would have got through it quicker if I hadn't kept interrupting him. But there's a 9-factor model about how to control your emotional state. And so this really started for him when he was working with young junior elite athletes who at one level are on poised to become the next rock star in the Premier League, and the next are out of it and not playing sport at all. And the mindset. So how do you equip these teenagers with the skill to continue to have a professional career? And then he's applied that in schools. And we go on to talk about how the amazing work he's done with coaching kids over a 6-week period to change their GCSE results between mock and real exams. Just absolutely fascinating. And in December, he realized that his energy state model, it is really applicable to AI and how humans interact with AI. And the medium state work is all being replaced. And many people find it impossible to access a higher state. And that leaves lots of people vulnerable to being replaced by AI and unable to change or retrain or upskill. And so he's got a mental model that talks about high performance, but also leads us right into why AI is so disruptive for the workplace. Just fascinating. As Matt, our producer, said to me as we wrapped up, we could have done 3 hours on this, but here we are. I'm sure we'll get him back on to do more and go deeper, particularly because the speed with which AI is evolving. I can see in 6 months' time, we'll have completely new things to talk about. So an absolutely fascinating conversation with Dr. John Finn. Enjoy.
Hey, well, thank you for having me. My name's Dr. John Finn. I'm the founder of Tougher Minds. I've worked in the fields of resilience, performance psychology, and leadership for over 25 years. I've got 3 degrees in these areas, including a PhD. And I started my career working in elite sport. So I was one of those on that first wave of sports scientists that was going into Premier League football teams, rugby teams, cricket teams, who were bringing in this new science of performance. And what I found really interesting when I was working in those teams was how there were lots of young, talented players that we may have acquired from other teams for significant amounts of money. But often a few years later, some of those players weren't worth anything. No one would even pay them a full-time wage to play professional sport anymore. So I did my PhD to look at the challenges of that transition from being one of the best in the world when you're 18, 19, to why people weren't necessarily even a professional anymore when they were 21, 22, 23, or why some of them, young men in my case, were worth maybe 10 times what they were worth when they were 18, and we were selling them on for huge sums of money. And my hypothesis there was that the key to success was how good you were at regulating your emotions. That is, being able to recognize whether the things you were doing and thinking every day were helping you to be at your best or were getting in the way of you being at your best. And if you recognize that they were unhelpful, you were able to regulate and do something different.
I'd just love to, I wasn't even thinking we would talk about something like this, but it's fascinating because I suppose if you look at someone like you watch Drive to Survive on Netflix? The Formula One?
No,
behind the scenes?
Formula One. I've seen this in the just in a little bit of it, yeah.
You're seeing these humans over many years, and Drive to Survive, you see sort of 9 months, and you see obviously a driver who has the talent, and they come under pressure, and then it's like, they just can't drive anymore. You know, like that. Well, I mean, you know, they're still much quicker than you and I, but, you know, it's fractions of a second, you know, at the front, and they just seem to lose it. So I'm just intrigued that, you know, what happens to somebody who's the best in the world at 18? Because I've had another guest on who had a Dutch guy on who'd been in the sort of Dutch National Academy. And then he's like, they just said, you haven't got the right mindset, you're out. And they didn't help him along the way. So what goes on for these young men then, in your case, that they go from being best in the world to not even playing sport?
Two core things, just using very plain language. They're not turning up every day and pushing themselves and learning and growing and getting better. Think of a Cristiano Ronaldo, maybe versus Wayne Rooney. Wayne Rooney still made it, right? But didn't play until he's not still playing now, right? And they're the same age. And then the second thing is, as you just said, performing under pressure. So can you go into the arena and can you do it when the pressure's on? Can you do it when you've had a setback? But underneath all that is understanding how your brain works. And these young people, they've had an immense amount of support for their physical development, for their technical development, for their tactical development, but literally no formal, what I would call first principle support for how their brain actually works, the thing that's driving all of their behavior, what they think and what they do, and how they can get it working better. So we knew that that was the case. So it was almost up to chance whether they were good at regulating, being able to turn up for work every day and push themselves hard so they could grow, develop, and then also perform under pressure when it mattered.
Was there something about how hard or how easy it had been to get to where they were 18? I just remember listening to people like Kevin Keegan say, I was never the most talented player in my whatever team I'd ever played in, but I worked hard, or, you know, I'm showing my age now, or Peter Beardsley, who's like, I'm getting older, I'm getting slower, I'm still playing in the midfield. I need to learn a new game, otherwise I'm not in the first team. There was like a curiosity that was part of their makeup because of how hard they'd had to work to get there in the first place. Was that a thing? Or
we can formally learn how to do things, or we can do it informally. So I remember hearing of a Aussie rules team that would only bring young men into their academy system if they had had adversity in their life. But we can do it formally as well. And that's basically what I've spent my career doing, is designing training programs that help people to get good at learning how their brain works and how to change their behavior if they need to, whether they're an individual, leader, team, across an entire organization. But what's actually happening now is that literally in real time now, when you're playing any sort of high-level sport, particularly in professional football, because there's so much money in that game. So you think the Premier League now is pretty much, they're all owned by billionaires, the clubs. They are working out your game in real time. That used to be done manually. Now they're using algorithms to do it. So whatever your strengths and weaknesses are, they're going to work them out faster than ever. So that's why the Cristiano Ronaldo story and maybe the Kevin Keegan story is so good, because they kept working. How do I get better? How do I get better? How do I get better? Now, of course, we've been brought up on the myth that we're only as good as our genetics, and that actually when we stop physically growing, our brain stops changing in any meaningful way. We got this technology about 25 years ago called functional MRI scanners that just completely debunked that myth. And it shows that what we practice is more informative for what we get good at than our genes are. So, you know, nature versus nurture is dead for anyone who knows anything about this. It's about nature plus nurture. And in fact, the nurture, the practice piece, is much stronger than we ever thought. And it's not just about practicing physical skills. We can practice psychological skills as well.
Well, it's fascinating, isn't it? Because there was that sort of, you know, your brain loses its plasticity. But both from a mental and a physical perspective, because there was a study recently where they had bed-bound women, I think, in their 70s, and they got them to do, you know, pretty light weightlifting with their arms, and enough that it improved their metabolic health that they could actually get out of bed, right? And the doctors had sort of given up on them. And this whole, oh, you hit sort of, I don't know, 50 or 60 or something, that's it, just like terminal decline to death. And it, you know, it's not that we just, people keep pushing the myth away or changing our perception of reality.
Yeah, I was lucky that when I did my master's, we actually had some of the top physiologists in the world who were working for NASA, and they were doing that type of research. They were looking at how do we combat the effects of not having gravity, right? When we shoot people into space. So they were doing trials with older people in the community to look at the muscle atrophy and dystrophy effects. But the other group of scientists I was working with were teachers who were really interested in all the data emerging out of the functional MRI scanners, which actually came out of France because the French government had decided to invest a lot of money into functional MRI scanners. So they had this technology en masse. And we were reading words like neuroplasticity for the first time. And it was being muted that, oh, you know what? Our brains might not be fixed. They may be malleable. They're like plasticine. And the trouble is, Dom, is that the vast majority, and I would go as far to say 99.9.9% of psychological support that's been on offer does not understand that the brain is a physiologically adaptive system. It works like a muscle. It gets good at what you practice. So if you practice thinking in a certain way, that's what you get good at. And that's why going for a CBT intervention is never going to change your behavior. Because it's not designed to. It's designed to give you some knowledge about what you might be able to do differently. If we want to help people to change, we got to help them to practice differently.
And stress. You know, it's that hormesis. You know, you got to do something. Otherwise, you got to have some sort of stress. Otherwise, the organism or the body or the cells don't adapt. So you got to practice different things. And also, you're going to be crap at it. I mean, you know, if it's skill-based or... you're going to be crap at it at the beginning as well. People don't like being crap at things, so they just give up.
No one is born being able to read or write. No one's born being able to do addition and multiplication and long division. They learn it. Everything we get good at, when we're born, there's very compelling data showing that babies don't know how to smile. They learn how to smile via mirror neurons in their brain by looking at other people. And so we are learning all the time. This is why the psychology is so far behind as an academic discipline, because the brain is the last thing we've actually been able to see in real time. And it turns out it's the most complex thing in the known universe. And this is why AI is so interesting, because it's the first time we've had technology that's modeled on how brains actually work via neural networks. But so it's learning all the time, AI. And it can learn. So this is my first book, The Habit Mechanic. That took me over 20 years to write. I can train an LLM on that in minutes.
Well, so two questions. Why have you got 3 degrees? Are they all in the same thing? When you say I've got 3 degrees in it, it's like, blimey, did you pick the wrong one? Or is it like...
No, it's a natural progression. So I did my undergraduate in sports science.
Right.
Physiology, psychology, right. Nutrition. Motor control, so learning how we learn.
Uh-huh.
And then I really like the psych piece, so I did my master's in sports psychology.
Right.
And then I went to work, I actually went for a technology company called Prozone.
Oh, yeah. The guy who have the thing that measures how people are running around on the field.
Yeah, so before we had GPS, we used to use trigonometry to work out how far people were running and whether how many passes they made, how many tackles they made, etc. So it was a software package. And my job was to help coaches to understand how to use that and interpret the data. But because I had this psychology background as well, I had this, I suppose, a unique set of skills. So I got employed by Brian Laws, who played for Brian Clough at Nottingham Forest.
Yeah.
And then that was my journey into professional sport. But yeah, Arsene Wenger was a huge advocate of Prozone. Clive Woodward was a pioneer in how it was being used. I got to work on the backroom staff of these teams and sort of see this recruitment piece, the development piece, see some kids doing really well, some others not doing so well. And that got me really interested in what's going on there. And at the same time, I was working a lot in professional golf. I created this system called the pre-shot system for the Professional Golfers Association that made it easier for golf coaches to teach the psychology of golf in their lesson. So with these big squares you put on the floor where you could map out what you were going to think before, during, and after you hit the golf ball. So again, practicing properly. Not just golf range golf is almost a different sport to normal to golf course golf, because people just stand there with a bucket of balls, they drag a ball to their feet, they hit the ball, right? When they're on the golf course and they hit a bad shot, they're like, oh no, I'm rubbish, I'm useless. So you've got to practice that element of the game as well if you want to have high quality, what we call deliberate practice. So my job is to help people to not just practice the physical, but practice the psychological side of things as well. And what I learned after my, and I did a PhD on that transition, that was my third degree, which was in sort of performance psychology, developmental psychology, sports psychology. What I learned was that we weren't very good at helping young people to practice how they were thinking and practice being good under pressure, or practice the things they needed to practice to make it easy for them to turn up every day and want to be at their best.
I'll come back to the other question in a second, but that I was listening to one of your podcasts, and it was about the truth about ADHD. And actually, that's the point that you made, is you gave the stat that some hospital in London had an 11,000 people waiting list to get an ADHD diagnosis. And you're like, but what will you do with the diagnosis? Like, you know, if you think you have ADHD or you have any of the symptoms of ADHD, you can do something today. You don't have to wait 2 years for a diagnosis. Like, you can start to control your behavior and be aware of how this manifests itself for you. Take control. Don't just be a victim.
Yeah, I mean, it is bad, isn't it? People have been exploited. I see ADHD tests popping up. Many academics would argue ADHD is not even a thing. Multiple things.
Yeah.
So it's not one thing. So what happens in psychiatry is that the psychiatrists, who are medical doctors who've decided to go down the pathway of doing more of a therapeutic approach, but they're licensed to prescribe medicine. So what they're looking for is a set of conditions. They're looking at analyzing someone's behavior, and then they go into their book. It's called the DCM something, produced by pharmaceutical companies. And they go down the list and say, right, that means we're going to prescribe you this drug. Most people don't know that. So pharmaceutical companies are looking for more people to want to be diagnosed with these conditions. And the medical model is broken. It's exactly the same thing as your example of older people who'd been given up on by doctors. Just by doing a few repetitions every day, they start to get these almost unbelievable improvements. So what we know is, I would say that most people, if they took an ADHD diagnosis as we see them, would have some form of, you know, there would be somewhere on that spectrum.
Yeah.
Because what we've been doing over the last 10, 15 years is practicing being unfocused. Yeah. Because we've got this screen and this screen and this screen, and we're practicing all the time switching attention. So the muscles in our brain that we use to focus have been weakened, or they've been trained to do something else.
There's so many more distractions. It's just like, you know, you've got to be deliberate about not being interrupted.
So we get good at what we practice. It's just that it's because we are so, our brain's number one operating rule is to save energy. And that's why it turns everything that it can into a habit, including worrying and beating yourself up or switching tasks when you get bored after 5 seconds. So people kind of understand the idea that you get good at what you practice, but practicing thinking is quite an intangible idea for people. But to make it more tangible, I would just say something like, don't think of a white elephant, and just recognize now how there is a white elephant in your head in some form or another. You haven't thought about it, it's there. And that's a mirror into the automaticity of how we behave. Most of what we're thinking and doing most of the time, some would argue all of the time, is automatic or semi-automatic processes. Some would argue that we're never conscious, because by the time you think you've got a conscious thought, it's so polluted with biases and belief systems. It's not actually conscious. It's not a fresh idea that's just come into your head. It's contaminated, for better or for worse, with all of the experiences that you've had in your life, right? But so we have this tiny bit of consciousness. And this is why AI is going to be so disruptive to the world of work, because it can do automatic, semi-automatic thinking processes like we've never seen before. I'm worrying you.
No. Well, what's interesting is when somebody tells me what the future of work's going to look like, it just makes me wonder, because I think back to other changes that have happened, like the internet and, you know, what people were saying in 1999 or 2000 about what the future of the world looked like as a result of the internet. And yeah, I'm not sure that most people can, you know, they'd already be billionaires if they could predict the future and it turned out they were right. But I do think that you've got a unique position because you're not predicting the future. You're just saying, here are some things that technology and the brain are already doing to interact, and AI is a magnitude different to that. Do you have a mental model that says this is how we need to approach AI?
Yeah, so let me tell you a short story of how I got into AI. So I'm in my, this is 2023 summer. So I've spent all my life, I'm not sort of a Johnny come lately to coaching or psychology. I've done it all my life. That's all I've ever done.
10,000 hours plus.
I'm in the London Science Museum in the gift shop at the end, of course, because they make you go through that. My partner was off looking at something else and I was looking at the book shelf. And I saw a book called The Genius Makers by a New York Times journalist, one of those New York Times bestseller books. And I thought, that's interesting. So I got the book and I read it. And it's about Geoffrey Hinton, who is the London-born academic, spent the early part of his career at UCL and then moved to Canada because no one was really interested in his work in the UK. And he's the guy that persisted with neural networks, a theoretical model that's been around since about the end of World War II. So the model's not new, but the technology to power it is. And what that got me hooked, because it's this model of AI that's based on how brains work. And I thought, well, I know quite a lot about how brains work, so this is interesting. So then since the summer of 23, I've been just following this. And then as the tech's become more powerful, we've been using it in our own workflows, getting our clients to use it. And about 9 months ago, we were so blown away by the results we were seeing that we said, right, we're gonna make this the core part of how we help people. Because the way we were helping people before that was very simple, simple equation. Help people to understand how their brain actually works.
Yeah.
Show people how to understand what it's doing and whether it's helpful for them or not helpful. And then anything they recognize that's not helpful, we show them how to use behavioral science so they can actually change their behavior. Habits are a really good unit to think about changing your behavior. And so we were helping people to become habit mechanics. What we now then get this technology that works in the same way fundamentally as brains work. So we added that into our equation. So it's help show people how their brain works. And I'll come on to a simple model in a second. Show them how to change their behavior using behavioral science, but then show them how to supercharge that by using AI technologies. Mm-hmm. And the easiest way to think about, so now we're helping people to become AI edge habit mechanics. The way that we think about the AI is it's like a snowmobile. Whether you want to build a better sleep habit, a better stress management habit, a better leadership habit, deliver faster and better for your clients, the snowmobile, if you learn how to use it properly, allows you to go further and faster up the mountain towards your goals mm-hmm. than we ever thought possible. So the way that we explain the brain, or one of the models we use, is our brain state model. And brains do run on states. We talk about three core states. There are a few more than that, but just to keep it simple. This is, so we can think about the brain as being like a battery. So in every 24-hour period, there's only so much charge. And our brain literally is like a battery. It runs on chemicals and electricity. And it operates in every 24-hour period, has the potential to operate in three core states. We've got the recharge state, where we are relaxing and we could be sleeping, but switching off as well. So we have sleep recharge and non-sleep recharge. We have the medium charge state, where we're doing fairly routine, automated, kind of boring work that our brain actually finds good because it doesn't take a lot of energy and our brain likes that. Mm-hmm. And we have the high charge brain state where we're doing high impact, clever problem solving work where we really have to focus. So we recharge, medium charge, high charge. That's a thumb going up on the screen, which is AI. Okay. When I look at AI, I'm thinking, right, where does it sit in this spectrum of our brain state model? What can it do? And the way that we are now, and this is evolving all the time, but for maybe the last 6 months, and well, I decided to write my new book, Train Your Brain for the Air Revolution, on the 17th of December, because I was seeing how powerful this technology was getting. So I first started to write about this in that book. And we can think of AI as having two core roles, or being able to do two core things in terms of brain function. One type of AI, and let's just give a practical example here. So people have a role, but they have tasks that they do every day that make the role up. So the role might be, I'm a sales and marketing manager, and I have loads of tasks that I do every day. Some of those tasks are medium charge brain state work, fairly mindless, easy, kind of boring, monotonous work. Other tasks are more high charge, high impact, complex thinking. AI can help with both. So our medium charge work, which might be, I've got to find some leads and I've got to write some copy for these leads and I've got to set up a workflow so I can automatically send out these emails to these leads. Medium charge brain state work can now be fully automated with agentic AI. And what we're going to start to see in the coming weeks and months are businesses unveiling agents that they've invested millions of pounds into. They are basically autonomous digital workers. They can't replace the sales and marketing manager, but they can pretty much do all of the medium charge work that they have been currently being paid to do. For the high charge work, what the sales and marketing manager can do, so let's say that they need to create, they've got a new product, they need to create a strategic go-to-market plan. Previously, they've had to really focus and think about that. Now they can co-work on that with the generative AI. Mm-hmm. That's things like ChatGPT, Claude, et cetera. That's not going to completely do the work for them, but they can co-work with it and they will do it much faster. So maybe it would have previously taken them a couple of days to put a good strategic plan together. Now they might be able to do it in a couple of hours. So go faster with the AI. So the AI is not going to replace the sales and marketing manager completely, but it can replace lots of the tasks that they currently do, the medium charge tasks. You can fully automate them. And it can help them to go much faster with the high charge, high impact thinking.
The last episode of the podcast, I don't know which order we'll be releasing them, so that might not actually be true. But we, the one that we put out most recently when we're recording this conversation was around AI, and it was recorded at the CEO summit that we ran. And Rob Elkin was one of the speakers, and he came on stage and developed some software live on stage. Right. He spoke to his computer and Replit created an app live on stage. Right. And it's just that, you know, 3 months ago, you couldn't do that. Like, Lovable is the fastest growing piece of software in the world ever. And it's not American. And the speed with which people can do that high impact stuff now is just incredible. And as you say, some of the agentic stuff, you know, I was watching something the other day, which is, you can, you know, connect Claude to your desktop applications using an MCP server. And so I can go onto Claude and I can say, write me a LinkedIn post and post it on LinkedIn. And from within Claude, it can go and post it on LinkedIn. Just, you know, you couldn't do that 3 months ago. It feels to me like things have moved in the last 3 months. Things have moved faster than they did in the previous, you know, the pace of change is just getting faster, I think. And as humans, we find exponential curves really, really hard to spot, but I think we are on that. It is changing so fast.
Yeah, I think just the last few weeks, we've seen huge acceleration. We had the government in London Tech Week came out saying the AI sector in the UK is growing 30 times faster than the rest of the economy. Right now, the AI sector in the UK is valued about 72 billion. This is government projections. They are projecting that in 10 years' time, by 2035, the AI sector will be valued in excess of 800 billion. 800 billion. That's about a quarter of UK GDP. We've seen Amazon come out and say, yeah, we will be replacing people with AI. We've had numerous companies lay off people and say, yeah, we've replaced them with AI. We're quite privy to a lot of conversations, and I know that some big businesses have been investing hundreds of millions in their own LLMs, for example. Yeah. And they've been telling me how these LLMs can in 15 minutes do what it would previously have taken 2 people 4 days to do. And they're projecting into the future, they're going to be laying off a lot of people.
How have you then taken this and integrated this with your work in terms of helping people manage their if I call it state awareness, is that the term you use, or have I just made that up as a way of describing what I think you said about managing your emotions?
Yeah, we call it brain state intelligence.
Okay.
Which is a slightly more accessible way of talking about emotional regulation in the way that we mean that. The trouble with academic language is every group of academics, it means something different, right?
So, okay.
But yeah, brain state intelligence, so getting aware about your brain states. Yeah, well, the key is if you understand, well, what can AI actually do, then you understand which brain state it fits into.
Right, okay.
And which brain state tasks it fits into.
Okay.
So instead of thinking about your team as roles, think about tasks.
Uh-huh.
And then which tasks can be fully automated, which tasks can be augmented and sped up. The AI, our point is that AI is useless unless humans can work with it. But we're only useful when we're working with it if we can get into high charge brain states. So what businesses are basically saying is, we are not going to pay human beings anymore to do medium charge brain state work because we can get the AI to do it faster and cheaper. The trouble is that most people struggle to do high charge work. Over 20,000 people a month being signed off on the sick with anxiety and depression, people report overwhelm, brain fog, can't focus. They're saying, I can't do high charge work, which means that we're not valuable anymore to organizations because the work we're doing, the medium charge stuff, can be automated, and it's more automatable every single day.
Let me interrupt the conversation just for a minute because I don't want you to miss this. My new book, Mind Your Fucking Business, is out on Amazon. If you're thinking yet another business book, I think you're wrong. This is actually a blueprint to cutting through the noise and achieving unparalleled success for you. It's based on 10 years of business coaching, spotting similar problems that people have had and coming up with real world solutions. If it's supercharging sales, if it's mastering talent acquisition, building a powerhouse brand, cultivating a company culture that breeds success, then this book is a ticket to your transformative journey. It's filled with practical tools and frameworks that I use every single day with my clients as part of their coaching program. If you want to take your business from good to great, look, you can go to Amazon and you can buy it, or you can click the link in the show notes and head over to monkhouseandcompany.com. I'll send it to you today. I'll send you a copy for free. I want to help you build a fantastic business. Now, back to the conversation.
How do we teach ourselves to be? And I guess the secret is, which is whether you're a footballer or whether you're an office worker or whether you're a leader or a manager or an individual, how do you train yourself? What are the habits that I need to put in place?
Well, you've got to become a habit mechanic, and that's why we wrote these two textbooks, essentially, and they're sister books. So Train Your Brain for Their Revolution and then The Habit Mechanic. And that's the sort of, they are the cornerstone texts of what we do.
So why did it take 20 years to write the first one?
It's highly complex, and people don't teach this at universities. They don't, because we're kind of stuck in the knowing. Uh-huh. If you tell people I need to eat 5 portions of fruit and vegetables a day and walk 10,000 steps, and they agree, great. The NHS in the UK is spending, I can't remember the figure, but I think it's about the significant amount of their budget goes on lifestyle-related diseases, which means that it's because people don't walk 10,000 steps a day and they don't eat 5 portions of fruit and vegetables and they don't sleep properly. Yet everybody knows more than ever that they're the things they need to do. So it's not about knowing, it's about building new automatic or semi-automatic behaviours. Uh-huh. In psychology, the word behaviour means what you think and what you do. Hence, become a habit mechanic. Now we can accelerate that bit by becoming AI Edge habit mechanics. And the key habits are actually what we call intelligent self-watching and intelligent planning. So that means getting above ourselves to actually be able to analyze our own behavior and then make tweaks and changes to it. But we've created an end-to-end system. So our AI Edge system isn't new. We're just recognizing, you know, it's built on the habit mechanic foundations, the thing we've built over 25 years. It's just recognizing where does the AI fit in and what can you outsource to the AI. We talk about AI in the habit mechanic, which I wrote and pulled together in 2020.
Yep.
But back then, you know, it wasn't particularly powerful.
What stops your system being another, you know, look, if knowledge is ubiquitous and you meet people who are not as thin as they would like, or not as fit as they would like, people say nonsense things like, oh, I'm not as thin as I would like, but I really love chocolate. And yet they're not doing anything about it. They're just, what, they're hoping that they get struck by lightning and turn into a thin person. I don't know. It's like, but that, you know, that's why winning the lottery is so appealing, I think, because you can, you don't have to work for this thing that you say you want. You just, you know, roll the dice every week. And, you know, how does having the knowledge of building habits make it possible to overcome this knowledge to execution gap and stick at it?
Yeah, well, it's the knowledge of becoming a habit mechanic, which is a step beyond knowing how to build habits. But
okay,
the key is understanding behavioral science.
Uh-huh.
And again, you go to the universities. I did a presentation for the British American Trade Association at the Chicago Booth University in the City of London, their campus there. And you walk in, you've got the Nudge Theory guys, they're academics at Chicago Booth. You go to Stanford, you've got BJ Fogg, Tiny Things. You go to somewhere else, wherever Carol Dweck is, Harvard, I think, you've got Mindset. And they will all tell you that they have cracked it. If you just do this thing, that will change your behavior. But not, it's not true. Academia incentivizes people to protect their theoretical model at all costs and say why everybody else is rubbish. So you've got all these tribes. So that's the work we had to do, is say, well, actually, what does drive people's behavior? So we've created our own proprietary, we call it the 9-action factor model. There are 9 factors that drive what we do. And a really simple way of explaining them is thinking about how we learn to drive, because learning to drive is a complex behavior. You can think of behaviors, the things that we think and do on a continuum. Some are simple, like eat more donuts, watch more Netflix, play the lottery more often. You don't need complex behavioral science to get people to do more of those things because they're easy to do, right? Complex behaviors like sleeping better, eating better, managing stress better, being a better leader, being a better parent, being a better team member, they're complex. Learning to drive is a complex behavior, so it's a good example. So when you learn to drive, that you've got to have these 9 things in play. So number one is your mindset. You've got to believe that you can learn how to drive, right? Otherwise, you're not going to be able to do it.
Okay. That and there are people who you can see that you know that talk themselves out of a thing and it's paralyzing, whether it's learning to drive or fear of spiders or fear of aeroplanes, you know, and if you're not afflicted by that phobia or lack of belief or belief in something else, you think it's completely bizarre and it's really hard to have empathy for people who you seem like it's beyond your comprehension because it's not a thing that you understand or could understand how they could be. You know, when somebody says, I don't believe I could learn to drive, you'd be like, what? How could you not believe to learn you could learn to drive? Like, what could be possibly going on in your head?
And if we go back, so we've built an understanding on just in the conversation is that we get good at what we practice, right? So that's the driver of what we get good at. David Beckham would never be a professional footballer if he didn't play football, right? It's not possible. So we get good at what we practice. And we've been conditioned to believe from a young age that we're good at what we're born to be good at. Just a born natural, just so naturally good at maths, so naturally good at sports, so naturally good at this, so naturally good at that.
There's a bit of that though, because there's a bit of it that, you know, I don't think David Beckham would have gone out in the backyard in the rain if he hadn't enjoyed it. But then reading Andre Agassi's autobiography, you realize that he never enjoyed playing tennis, but he was made to play tennis because his father, I think, could see that he had the potential and it could earn money for the family. And then, of course, that ends up being his job, right? And he ends up being amazingly successful. So you can force yourself to do something that you don't enjoy. If you do have a natural propensity for maths, or if you're dyslexic and you don't have a natural propensity for spelling or reading, I can see how, you know.
So now you're moving on to a different factor.
Okay, right.
We've got to stay focused on. So
yeah, go on.
Well, there's a few things there. One is I'd say Andre Agassi's retrospective account of his life, probably isn't what he felt in every single moment of it. We get broadly conditioned to believe that we're either good at something or we're not. We know that's not true. It's a combination of nature plus nurture. And the nurture part of the practice is playing a bigger role. And this is the problem now in education. Carol Dweck's work really broke through in education. We've got to create growth mindset. But now they're telling all the kids they've got ADHD and therefore they'll never be able to do that. Those two things don't sit together. They're nonsensical, but they're completely human.
There's a consulting business that we worked with, and they would hire some of the smartest people out of McKinsey and, you know, Deloitte and stuff. And these were people who had been top of their class all the way through school, top of their class all the way through university, you know, and then they'd worked at McKinsey and they're pulling them out and putting them in their business. And they're like the smartest of the smartest. And he said, the first thing we've got to do is, it's the first time in their lives, they're in a room with 10 people and they're not the smartest person in the room. And it's like the psychological shock of that was horrific. And so the first few weeks of onboarding are about helping people understand that they thought they were amazing at something. And actually, here's a room full of people who are all better at that thing that they thought that they might be the best in the world at, and they're not. And that was really psychologically challenging for the people that they hired. And so they'd had to put mechanisms in place to help support them.
So that's the third element of the model. this is why it took 20 plus years to put this together. It's highly complex.
Yeah.
So you've got to believe, let me just whiz through them.
Yeah, go on then. I'll stop talking.
You've got to believe you can do it. You've got to break it down into tiny steps, which you do. In your first driving lesson, typically don't drive anyway, just learn where things are in the car. When we're trying to lose weight, if you can't do it after a week, you give up. I'll never be able to do it. When you're trying to learn how to focus properly, I'll never be able to do it if I can't do it after a few days. So tiny factories is another one. Then we've got motivation. And sorry, just go back to the tiny factor. We accept that it's going to take 3 months, 6 months, lots of lessons to learn how to drive. Motivation. People who've learned how to drive did it for a reason. There's a bigger reason. I had to get the kids to school. I had to get to work. I wanted to be the first person in my peer group to do it. Next one, you may have all the motivation, but you need knowledge and skills. That's why you have driving lessons. Again, learning how to manage stress better or build a better sleep habit or becoming a better leader doesn't happen magically. It's not as easy as picking up a donut and putting it in your mouth or turning on the Netflix. So we have to have knowledge and skills, so we have driving lessons. Connected to that is, it's really helpful if we have people around us who have those same knowledge and skills beyond our driving instructor, like our parents. If our parents knew how to drive, they could take us for a free driving lesson. That's really helpful in the supermarket car park before they were open on Sundays. Next one is social influence. So if your father doesn't believe in the speed limit, my father was one of those. I once had to go to county court with him because he was going to get banned. He had to drive a lot. I was going to have to drive him back anyway. Different story. We have to be surrounded by people who are modeling the right behaviors so that we've got good role models. People get that. The next one is reward and penalty systems. So when you're learning to drive, if you drive well, you get your license. If you continue to drive well, you keep your license, your car insurance goes down. If you don't drive well, you might not get your license or you might lose it. You get points on your license, monetary points, your car insurance goes up. Your consultancy example sits within there because those people are used to everything they contribute. Well done, you're great, you're fantastic. All of a sudden, when they're not getting that, they get a penalty system piece going on. So they withdraw and they're questioning themselves, right? We have triggers. So when we're driving, governments have worked out it's largely autonomous like everything else. So if we don't constantly keep reminding people what to do, the accident rates go up. That's why now you get a ping, ping, ping if you don't put your seatbelt on. You have a speedometer in front of you. You have signs in the road constantly reminding you what to do. And then the final one is brain states. So if you try to learn to drive when you're sleep deprived, you're not going to be able to do it well. If you're trying to learn how to use AI well when you're sleep deprived, you're not going to be able to learn how to do it well. So this is back to the brain state intelligence piece. All those nine factors are working together all the time. They don't only run our own lives. They run our family units. They run our teams. They run our organizations. And we break that down into about 250 tactics that you can use to get those factors working for you.
Just give me a concrete example, just to take it back to something which is physical rather than so take it back to your elite sportsman at 18. What proportion of them were failing to still be in the professional game before you built the program? And what proportion of the ones who were falling out of the program are you able to save, do you reckon? Because it feels like they must be reasonably motivated. Here you are, you're 18, you could be a professional footballer. Feels like there could be some motivation there.
So motivation is one of 9 factors.
Yeah. But as opposed to, I meet people who are overweight who seem to have no motivation to weigh less. Do you see what I mean?
I do, but it's not about the motivation. This is oversimplistic to say that, and that's why it's about the 9 factors.
Right.
So one factor is not, there are 8 other things working.
Yes.
So motivation can be low and we could still get people going in the right direction.
Okay.
If we get the other 9 the other 8 factors aligned. But let me give you some even more concrete examples. So after elite sport, I went to work in education. I went to work for the Haberdashers, who are a City of London livery company, and they now invest a lot of their money into education. So I got given a blank piece of paper, bring what you know from sports psychology into the school across the piece, not just for sport. So I was the performance psychology fella. That was in the build-up to the London Olympics 2012 games. Colin Moynihan, I believe, he was Olympic, he was a Cox, but he got a gold medal, I think, or an Olympic medalist, sports minister. And at that time, he was the head of the British Olympic Association, also a haberdasher. Said, why, I've always benefited from sports psychology. Why wouldn't you teach these skills to young people? So my job was to go to do that. So I created this educational program. What we were able to then demonstrate with that education program that then grew and that became the foundation of Tougher Minds. And our work in the City of London and in business and in America grew out of that because we taught the parents as well. And they said, this is better than the things we do at work. Can you come into our businesses and do this? But so you can take, in the educational context, you can take a group of, let's say, GCSE students in their mock exams and then their real examination data. So you have some quite robust sets of data there. So you've got a baseline data when they're doing their mock exams, either before Christmas or after Christmas. And then we would take some kids, put them into our intervention and teach them to become habit mechanics. We wouldn't teach them anything about their subjects. We just teach them how to build better habits so they could learn more efficiently and effectively. Every child, on average, makes progress between their mock exams and their real GCSEs. So on average, every kid's grades are better. The kids in our intervention, so a 6-week intervention, improved by an extra 0.5 grade on average per subject. That is unheard of.
Yeah.
Some of those kids were jumping from, let's say, a D to an A in subjects because they were equipped with the skills when they were sitting down and either in class studying or doing their private study to actually focus properly and actually learn properly. And then the things that they did in between their bouts of learning also improved their learning. Because a lot of the learning we do is when we're sleeping, for example.
It's fascinating because my younger two are 11 and 9. And, so we've obviously, there's parents at the school who have older kids who are doing GCSEs, or I've got colleagues whose kids are doing GCSEs. And everybody says the schools never teach the kids how to revise. Like, they teach them the subject, but that whole 6-week intervention is completely missing from any curriculum, and the parents are like, obviously the parents are saying, I'm trying to tell him what he should be doing differently. And I'm, given feedback on my parental intervention. I wish the schools would teach them how to revise. It's fascinating.
If we propel that now into the AI world of work, the biggest bottleneck, so if you look at all the data that's coming out, most businesses are not currently getting a return on investment from their AI investments. Some have spent hundreds of millions, yet they've all given technical training. They've taught them technically how to use the system, right? But people are not able to get the most out of the tech because their brain states are not optimized. So really what we were teaching the kids for their GCSEs to become habit mechanics, to become brain state intelligent, is exactly the same training we need to unlock the potential of AI in the world of work. And that's what we're doing, which is unique. I'm not hearing anyone else even talk about this yet. So the key, a bit like Agile and Lean Sigma 6 were the keys to unlocking the one advanced manufacturing revolution and then Agile, the sort of digital revolution, the key to unlocking, we believe, the AI revolution is brain state intelligence, because we now have technology that can do what our brain can do for the first time ever. So we have to get really intelligent about what our brains can do.
And I think, I'm sure you won't be shy in telling me if I've got this right or wrong, but there's a number of people had said to me that large enterprises who had acquired the technology, like an AI assistant for all of their employees. And then, you know, 98% of the employees were doing nothing with the AI. You know, because to train the AI, you know, they said actually the managers can do something because they're used to thinking, how do I take this into a set of tasks and teach somebody something, you know, because I've got a new employee. And so if you've never had an employee, you've never had to, I suppose as a parent, you know, the first time you've tried to teach somebody to drive is when one of your kids jumps in the car and you realize it's quite hard because you realize that you know a thing, but telling people what you know and explaining to them how to break it down into a series of instructions is really hard. And actually, interestingly, when I've been playing with Replit and some of these vibe coding tools, you think you've told it to do something which is really clear, and it gives you something back which is just not what you thought you were going to get at all. And you realize when you look at what you've asked it to do, you weren't precise enough. It's interpreted your instructions differently. And so that's all higher order activity. And if your job doesn't involve any higher order activity, it doesn't matter if I give you an AI, that bit is missing. Your model explains why it's not working in so many organizations, because they just, people have never developed or have lost the habit of higher order activity.
That's it. So we have to be Cristiano Ronaldo if we want to thrive in the new world of work. And it's going to, I'm used to the first professional profession I went into, professional sport, football in particular, if you don't perform, they just sack you. That's it. You know, managers get sacked after losing three games now. If there's three games on the bounce, there's rumours in the press they're going to get sacked. We are going into a world of work now, which is going to be much more like elite sport. If you can get into those high charge brain states consistently, you are going to be, get old. I mean, Mark Zuckerberg is paying $100 million sign-on fees to an elite team of developers, which doesn't quite sync with the point I'm making, but just to show the money that's going to be available if you can win in this space. The tech you're talking about to build agentic AI, people are saying that technology will create the first ever unicorn business from a solopreneur. And those technologies you're talking about also, you know, they've been around for maybe 18 months and they're valued about 10 billion. We haven't seen that before. Everything is going faster.
The other meta trend is that this technology would historically have been enterprise level technology, and it would have been £1,000 per user per month. And it's $20.
It's free.
And so 40 years in total, maybe 20 years in really to move everything to SaaS. And now lots of these tools are going to go from SaaS tools are going to move to, I'm just going to build my own thing. And there's going to be another massive disruption and change in terms of the tech layer in businesses.
Yeah, so we're moving to service as a software. So the service will be delivered by the software.
Yeah.
So people are not recognizing we work one-to-one with people. We work with businesses. We train people to become what we call certified human AI performance psychology coaches. That's a new field of psychology we created. We just had a solicitor who got an overnight $70,000 pay rise because she's brain state intelligent and her business can see that. They gave her equity in the business because she knows how to get her brain singing and get the AI singing, and she can move faster than anybody else can. Then how are you doing that?
Is brain state intelligence the same as being in a flow state?
Flow is a myth, I would say.
Oh, perfect.
It's a myth in terms of how much is attributed to it. I've actually spoken to Mihaly Shevchukovsky, who created this. A big chunk of my PhD work is in positive psychology, and he was at a positive psychology conference I was at.
Yeah.
And he's like, yeah, in sport, flow is massively exaggerated. Flow is tiny little snapshots. What we need to do to be brain state intelligent is be very conscious and vigilant about making sure we're at the right level. So deliberate practice is not easy. It's hard. The flow is the enjoyable bit. And it's very rare that we get into flow states. And what essentially AI is doing is pretty much anything you can do in a flow state is disrupting it. So you might be merrily typing away and doing your medium charge habit work, and it's all good and I feel fine and this is great. That's what AI is replacing every day. The high charge brain state, when you get into those complex brain state, it doesn't feel maybe great in the moment, but what you produce at the end of it makes you feel really good. You've got to battle with good strategy ideas and innovation. There might be bits of it where you're feeling really good, but most of it isn't. That's how I would interpret it.
No, that's good. Thank you for coming on. This has been absolutely fascinating.
Well, thank you for having me, and I hope it's got people thinking.
Where's the best place to get a hold of you? LinkedIn or email, hit your website, sign up for your newsletter, listen to your podcast, all of the above?
Yeah, so tougherminds.co.uk is our website. You can contact us through there. We've got, I'd say the best book to start with is Train Your Brain for the AI Revolution. That's available on Amazon. There's a free mini course we have on our website, tougherminds.co.uk. I'm reasonably active on LinkedIn, Dr. John Finn. Can get the access to our podcast on the website as well. Loads of ways to learn more about what we're doing. But really the key, as I don't suppose we've mentioned, is our goal is to help people, first of all, to create their own high-performing human AI team, and then help businesses to create human AI teams, because that's the transition we're going on, moving away from teams of humans to smaller teams of humans who are co-working in harmony with AI and going faster than we ever thought possible.
Fab. John, thank you very much.
Thank you.